Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with the extraordinary Peggy Roeder. I have been wanting to do this interview for a very long time. I saw her first, but ever since then, I have been blown away by each succeeding performance at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. At the beginning of the interview, she will recount some of the plays that she's done here. I have seen almost all of them and have, as I said, been surprised, delighted, impressed by the extraordinary range of this actor. So listen to Peggy talk about how she became the person that she is and the story of her journey from young girl with no particular interest in theater to this person who has dedicated, as she says, 40 years to this work. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
about being who you really are. Not pretending to be somebody, not trying to be somebody, not wishing that you were somebody else, or that you had this or that quality, or that you could do this or that thing, or that you had learned this or that skill, but staying still for the moment and being who you really are. As a therapist, I am aware that many too many people are doing all those other things, trying to be somebody they're not, pretending to be somebody they're not, wishing that they were somebody else, berating themselves because of what they didn't do or because of what they did do. And I understand powerfully how debilitating that is, how difficult it makes to enjoy your life, to have pleasure in your life, if you are continually trying to deny yourself and be something else. It's also pretty clear to me that the most comfortable people, the happiest people, the most content people are those people who are actually who they are. They're not at war with themselves. In my book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call this a civil war, the battle between the person you are and the person you have decided you had to be, should have been, wanted to be. No one wins this battle. This is lose-lose. And the person stuck in this battle is condemned to unhappiness. So my work as a therapist is all about trying to help people recover the pieces of themselves that they have denied, the pieces of themselves which their childhood, and so many of our childhoods have done this, have taught them to despise, dislike, be shy of, embarrassed, or ashamed of. It is recovering these pieces of yourself, accepting all of who you are, and going from there that makes for comfort, for happiness, for peace, for contentment, for serenity. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because when you listen to such people, you can hear what it sounds like to be what we therapists call congruent. Another way of saying what you hear is what there is. What you see is what you get. These people, at least in the area of their work, are so very much who they are. And of course, it is my hope that when you hear that, you ask yourself, in what way am I not like this? How can I recover the pieces of myself that I was forced to deny so that I too can sound like the person I really am and enjoy it? The interview I'm airing today is with actor Peggy Roeder. And as I said in the run-up, I've really wanted to do this for a very long time. I am a very big fan of Peggy Roeder's. Peggy is currently starring in The Matchmaker and has a character role in the production of Good People, both of which are playing concurrently at the Oslo Repertory Theatre, and you will hear Peggy talk about what it's like to do repertory theatre, where you have to do two roles at the same time, sometimes in the same day. In this show, I am playing Reviews by Sharon Leslie Orenstein. The first review is for Matchmaker, which I'm going to play right before my interview with Peggy, and then after Peggy's interview, I'm going to play Sharon's review of Good People. Peggy's story is interesting because also, as I said in the run-up, she didn't know that she was an actor for a very long time. And that's, for me, quite remarkable when you see that she is a quintessential actor. Anyway, here is Sharon's review of Matchmaker, and following that is Dolly Gallagher-Levi, The Matchmaker, Peggy Roeder. Sometimes it's hard to watch the original play on which a successful musical was based, like watching Pygmalion without the music from My Fair Lady, or reading The Wizard of Oz without Somewhere Over the Rainbow. But since I performed The Matchmaker when I was still in college, I have always had a soft spot in my heart for the Thornton Wilder play upon which Hello, Dolly! Was formed. Watching opening night of The Matchmaker at the Oslo Repertory Theatre brings to mind marriage advice to brides. Carry something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. I think that the wily matchmaker Dolly Levi would have approved of such a sentiment. While the play is 60 years old and known, it did not feel tired or dated. Director Peter Amster brought something new, shadings of character, touches of turn-of-the-century songs, some fun comic staging, and a light-hearted touch to that old battle of the sexes in the should-I-or-shouldn't-I marriage dance. One of the fun aspects of this play is how Thornton Wilder plays youthful marriage goals against the marriage needs of someone older. The younger couples want attraction, love, and adventure. The older couples want monetary security, a well-run home, and, well, a slightly smaller dose of adventure, but still some adventure. No one wants to be bored, particularly Dolly. The borrowed part of the marriage advice is that we recognize some of the stuck qualities in how the characters function in the story. The blue part is not the color blue, but the mood. Most of the characters are slightly unhappy and want to make a change in their lives. In The Matchmaker, the characters of Dolly Levi and Horace Van de Gelder are equally balanced, unlike in the musical. Horace announces his plans to go to New York to propose to the widow Mrs. Molloy. Dolly has been helping Horace find a bride. Since he wants a younger woman, Dolly plays that ambition to the hilt by suggesting a 19-year-old for the 60-ish Horace. Next, Van de Gelder's chief clerk, Cornelius, is bored with his life in Yonkers and drags his fellow clerk, Barnaby, out for an adventure in the big city of New York. They vow to kiss a girl before they leave. Serendipity plants Cornelius and Barnaby in the hat shop owned by Mrs. Molloy. And, as in all good comedies, there are unexpected twists of fate. Mistaken identities, much wrangling over money, tests of character and morals, and reflections on the human condition. Generally, chaos must reign before a happy ending can tumble out. Peggy Roeder, as Dolly Levi, is human, caring, and wise about what drives people to action. Stephen Hendrickson brings out the cold and calculating nature of Horace Van de Gelder. He is not a likable character until the surprising thaw near the end. As Cornelius, Buddy Hart brings the charm of a Tom Hanks to the role. As his romantic interest, Olivia Williamson is a feisty Mrs. Molloy, full of energy and a not quite repressed passion. Carolyn Michael rules the stage as Miss Van Heusen, the older spinster. Both Doug Jones and David Braithwaite bring welcome comic chops to their small roles. While this is not a belly laugh kind of comedy, it is entertaining, charming, and full of joie de vivre. There is a wonderful amusement and patience with all that is human and fallible about living life. If you want to be taken out of your world and placed in another time and space where tears are not allowed, you will thoroughly enjoy a night spent with Dolly Gallagher-Levy, The Matchmaker. Okay, so I'm here with Peggy Roeder in the little conference room at the Oslo. And Peggy is currently starring in both Matchmaker and
Good People.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But I have seen Peggy now in Grapes of Wrath and My Fair Lady and You Can't Take It With You. Did I miss anything?
Oh, did you see Vanya Sonia Marsh?
Oh, right? God, yes. And Vanya, yes. Oh, you were amazing.
And Philadelphia Here I Come.
I saw
And Games Afoot.
And did I see Games Afoot?
For the first season. It's the silly,
maybe I missed Games Afoot.
The murder mystery comedy thing. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Well, I saw all the other ones.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to interview you since. It's because you're so remarkable. Oh, my God.
Thank you.
It's not just, in my view, good acting, which you absolutely clearly are. I guess that is, it's just simply good acting, is that you are whoever it is you're being.
Thank you.
And they're so dramatically diverse. It's remarkable to observe, and I'm truly honored to be talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You know, I read, this was years ago, I've read a few biographies of Laurence Olivier. He's well documented. And I believe it was a double bill, because he was with I think it's the National Theatre, whatever the one that he then took over in London. And this goes back, you know, years, when he was in his maybe 40s or something. He had a double bill of Oedipus and the Entertainer. So,
yes,
black and white,
right?
And he was being complimented on his, you know, his ability to do it. And he said, it's showing off. We love doing that. That's what actors love to do, is show that kind of range. We love to show off. And it hit me that it really is the very thing that when you're 5 years old and you come in and you say, hey, Mom, watch me do this, jump the rope or do whatever it is, and you want somebody to say, oh, isn't that good? And, oh, I'm so proud of you. And to be handed roles that get to show that spectrum is such a treat. You know, as an actor, it's just, good. I get to be that far away from myself and that far away from those characters. I always feel bad for somebody who reaches a movie stardom and is only gets offered typecast.
Right.
Because as an actor, that's the last thing you want to do is the same thing again. You know, it's like, oh my God, I get to go into this world, or I get to use this part of my voice, or I get to play physically with my body somehow. But when it hit me when Olivier said it, and I've often, and at that point, of course, I was lucky to be getting two roles a year, let alone anything in rep. And so to get to this point now, I'm like, oh, now I know what he means. You know, it's really fun. Last year was an amazing season for me. Wouldn't have traded for the world those three roles. Any one of them would have been a gift. But to get, or even two, but to get to do those three, Philadelphia Here I Come, Vanya and Sonia, Masha and Spike, and Grapes of Wrath was just an enormous gift.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll just say it again. I'll say what you're saying is that they talk about being on the spectrum. I mean, they had nothing to do with each other.
Right.
You know, they weren't the same age. They weren't the same ethnicity.
Right.
They weren't the same. They had nothing.
Right.
They, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's glorious to watch. It's just really glorious. Like, you can show off for me anytime.
Oh, good. Well, it's interesting that I think that a rep season involves an audience in ways that a normal subscription doesn't, because I think it's just as fun for them. If in fact Olivier's saying that we get to show off, well, your mother likes watching you jump rope. I think the audience enjoys coming back the next night and seeing, wait a minute. Oh, she has a wig on now and it's different or whatever. I think they get personally involved in the process in a way that doesn't happen in non-rep. You know, rep is hard to do for a theater because, you know, these sets go in and out in an hour. If you're doing two different shows on a given day, we come down. And that crew has to change that set over, and the costumer has to bring a whole new rack into your dressing room. So it's a huge undertaking for a theater, and so I'm just so glad that somebody's still doing it. You know, there's a few. I think. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if Ashland, Oregon, that you know the Shakespeare Festival mm-hmm. there. I don't know if they do rep, because they have different theaters. I think they have more than one theater. So I don't think there's many. I don't know if there's many places rotating rep. I should say rotating rep, because a lot of people call it a repertory because they've done one show for 3 weeks and then they do the next show for 3 weeks. And the next
right,
week.
Right, right.
But we're doing them all at one time.
And right.
It's a huge undertaking, and I'm so glad that this theater still is committed to doing that.
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't thought. What you were saying about the what the audience experiences, I thought you were going to say something else, and this is what occurred to me. As a part of the audience, it's exciting for me, it's pleasing for me. You know, in the way that you said, you know, mother enjoys saying, oh, good for you, I really like that. Well, as an audience member, I have the same thing. Oh, my God, look at her, look at that.
Yeah.
I saw her do this, and now I see her do this. Oh, my God. And it's different for me as an audience member because I have an attachment to you in a way that I wouldn't if I saw you in one play and then I go to another play with a whole other
right.
cast, right?
Right.
So I had never thought of that.
Yeah.
But I think it's true. There was a year when I bought season tickets to a baseball, that we used to have a little AAA baseball team here.
Right.
And you sit in the same seat every game, and there were 70 home games. So 70 times if you went to all the games, right? And all the people sitting in that section had been sitting in that section for years. And they knew all the players.
Right.
And they knew they would say, "Don't curse, Tommy." And, you know, I mean, they had an attachment to the players because
right.
they saw them continually. They saw them grow, you know.
Right.
And I do think that that's something I've certainly never thought much about or heard anybody talk about, the effect of, well, rep in this case, on the audience, the impact that it has. Because I would want to come and see a show just because you're in it,
well,
because I've
you.
Seen you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's what we could only hope. I mean, and then the opposite is true also. I mean, I have people that, I mean, we all have our movie stars that
yes,
we're like,
right.
oh, if, you know.
Yes. Denzel.
Meryl Streep or Denzel, whoever
right,
it is.
Right.
Oh, I have to, oh, I want
I gotta
to
see that. Right.
Even when people said, I don't think that movie's that great.
I don't care.
I'll watch them read the phone book, whatever. And then there's other people that the movie may be lauded. But for your best friend sitting next to you can love that person. You're like, oh, I don't know. I don't like them. And it's so, there's nothing, it's hard to even put a finger on why it is you don't like them, because you have to recognize and give them props for their talent.
Right.
You have to give them props for the fact that they are working all the time. But what is it about them that, you know, and so we can only hope as artists, but that would be true no matter what art you're in. If you are a visual artist, if you paint,
right.
you have to hope that people want to look at your work. Why is it that we want to look at that artist and we don't want to look at this one?
You're a songwriter.
Exactly. You know, we can only go out there and do our work and give our opinion and bring our humanity to it and hope that that more than a few people want to see that, and more than a few employers want to hire you
yeah.
to do it. You
yeah.
know,
well,
it's such a crapshoot.
It is a crapshoot,
yeah.
and clearly these employers want to keep hiring you, and these audiences keep wanting to see you.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. I've been based in Chicago for most of my career. I did live in Los Angeles.
Well, wait, hold on, because I haven't asked you the only question I ask.
Oh.
And it is, since I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and clearly the art to which you are giving your life is acting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when, look, Ma, I'm doing this, or stories, or being paid attention to, or any of that drew you, captured you?
Well, it actually, it's not a straight line from this, because I didn't recognize that I was going to do it professionally until I was
well, we'll get
20.
There.
But my father was a policeman in the Chicago area, and he was a song and dance man, and it was his dream to pursue this as a career. He got married, they started to have kids, they had more kids, and they ended up with 7 kids. So he kind of put that aside, but he became, he was a policeman, so any policeman's ball, any policeman's benefit, he was the guy at the microphone telling some jokes, doing a few tap dance steps, whatever, singing a few songs. And so I was given that kind of energy through him, and my mother is Welsh, and so that's where I think I got my voice, because Welsh people are, you know,
yes.
Fred Turfel and Tom Jones and whoever else. There's a gift. I mean, if in fact, you know, every nationality or whatever has a certain thing, and I think a lot of Welsh people, I was given a voice that can handle being on stage. And plus, my mother also loved to sing and did amateur theatrics. And so my sisters and I, because my brothers weren't involved until we pulled them in, my sisters and I organized shows in our basement when we were in grade school. And and it became a thing over about 4 or 5 years, where the neighborhood looked forward to that in July, because we'd bring all the other kids in, and we did some original scripts. We did Hansel and Gretel, we did Snow White, whatever, and we'd, you know, like 5 cents a ticket or whatever, and we'd sell lemonade, and all the money, which, you know, ended up, I think the most we ever got was like $18 or $19, but, you know, with nickels, that's
really
a lot. We donate it to CARE, C-A-R-E, and I don't remember what that stands for, and I don't know that that charity is even around anymore. Isn't that funny? But it was, you know, we picked this charity and we sent it. That's what.
And how old were you?
So we would have started that one when I was, let's say, 9. So McGee would have been, my sister would have been about 10. My other sister would have been 7. And then we went on for about 4 or 5 years doing that. And then in...
Well, wait, I want to ask you about this.
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
Very much so, yes. It was, and the thing is, some of them we wrote, but if you didn't write it, but the Hansel and Gretel, it's not like we got a script anywhere. We knew the story, we wrote it down, we memorized lines, we organized costumes, we made a set, we set up chairs, we made the programs to take them to different, or the flyers to take them around the neighborhood. We did all the things, you know.
My God.
I know.
Where did you learn that?
I know. Well, first of all, this even goes back to something else, though. That this is a digression from theater, but I am forever grateful to my grandparents lived with us, my dad's parents. And from my grandpa, I worked in the shop. He had a shop in the basement, and he helped me build a dollhouse when I was, you know, starting when I was about 8 years old. And he also helped instill a great financial sense in me. He was the one that started bank accounts for all of us. And I think it's one of the reasons I've been able to do this for 40 years is because I know how to balance a checkbook. I live modestly. I have lived modestly for 40 years, but that's why I've been able to live as an artist. I don't owe anybody any money, mm-hmm. and I'm still doing what I want to do. And I think it's because he gave that, he gifted me that. Now, I also think maybe I took to it, and maybe you could teach someone else, and they wouldn't be able to balance a checkbook. Those sound very simple, like, you know, very simple basic things, but my God, what else do you need in life except an appreciation of art and balancing a checkbook, right? And so, to feed yourself. And so, we all had a sense of, we knew how to be assigned a task and finish it. I mean, we all had chores in the house. We all participated in making it run. And so when it came time then to organize this event, because my mom, I mean, with 7 kids, I mean, she wasn't, I mean, my God, she was involved in the sense that she encouraged us, but this was not her bossing us around. It was like, oh, okay, you girls are going to do that, then do it, you know.
Okay, wait, I want to stop you for some. First of all, I'm curious, do you remember whose idea it was? And second, I mean, all of these tasks, the script, the costume, the set, had you seen theater? I mean, where did you get this?
You know,
they're very specific.
They are very specific. At that point, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think I saw my first professional show until I was probably 12. It was a touring show, a touring company. Is this possible? I would have to look up the date, but I think it's possible. A Fiddler on the Roof, downtown Chicago. Is that possible? It's funny now, or was it Music Man? No, Music Man was my first professional show downtown with Forrest Tucker. He was in the tour of it. So at that point, I don't think any of us had seen that much live theater, but I think there is something in the genes, is what I'm saying. We had loved it in the house. And, you know, my dad played a little piano, played a little drums, played a little trombone, and he had friends, and about monthly or every 2 months, they would call. We lived on Harvey. They called themselves the Harvey Avenue Symphonettes. They'd come over. There was a violinist. There was a guy who played trumpet. And they'd come over, and they would just jam in the living room. And we would just sit around and listen. And it was...
Yeah, but you didn't become a musician.
Right, right. But there was performance.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes,
there was
yes,
performance
yes.
around. And so I don't know how...
Well, you don't see that it's kind of ironic that a 7-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 12-year-old create...
I know. No, it's...
Essentially, you know, full-blown productions.
The very first one started, I say in the basement, but the first one started because Mom said clean the garage. And it was a 3-car garage that was falling down. It had to be repaired a few years later, but I mean, she just wanted it. I mean, and I don't even know if that was just one of those. It was summer, you know. I don't know if that was just get the girls out of the house and get them doing something, or if it really needed. But we, you know, we set things up against walls, whatever. We moved stuff around and we swept the floor, and we said this would be a great place for a barn dance. And we decided to have a square dance, and so we, you know, I there's no photos of any of these. Now everything would be so documented, you know. It's kind of interesting that it's all in our memory now. It's not on in black and white, which would have been the color of the photos in the 50s. And so we did this thing where we square danced, and it was, you know, my mom and dad and the few other neighborhood kids that were at it, their parents. So it's not a big deal. It was not, you know, maybe, you know, 10 to 15 people watching us, because there was probably, you know, this was on the west side of Chicago. We were near the west side of Chicago. I actually was in Oak Park. This was a lot of families with lots of kids. And so we just square danced. And everybody thought, oh, it was just so great. It was so wonderful. And that's when we first, we decided to charge money. And we, I don't know, for that maybe we got $2. And we gave it to charity. And then, and we said, oh, we should do this. And so that summer moved into an actual show in the basement. And that was such a fun thing for us. The next summer, we said, oh, we're going to do this again. And then it just stayed that way for about, I think it was 5 summers. Maybe it was 4 summers in a row. And so it came out of doing this, you know, cleaning the floor like a Cinderella on her knees or whatever, but saying, oh, you know, we should do this with it. You know, just making something out of it.
It's real interesting. I mean, that you all had this impulse to perform.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Okay, so you said that you didn't decide to make this a career until you were 20, but what happened after this? I mean, did you audition for shows in school? Was there a drama class? Was there forensics? Did you take acting lessons?
When I went to an all-girls Catholic school on the west side of Chicago, and it was, they did like one show a year. And in fact, I had to laugh when I saw South Pacific this year. We got boys from the other Catholic boys' schools in the area to be in it, but they had to make some changes. I played Captain Brackett. Which still, I'm not sure really works for that to be a guy, because when I saw it again, I thought, what did they do with all that stuff
with the kissing
or whatever? Right, but whatever, right, I don't remember that. But I mean, everyone else was played by the right gender, but it was just a little. They had to make the little change. But that was my senior year. Up till then, I hadn't done any shows. I was president of my class every year, and then president of the school in senior year. I was much more involved in the school politics and in the religious club that I was in, the National Honor Society. It was just other things. So when I went to college, I actually I wanted to be in the space program. I wanted to be part of NASA. And I wasn't sure I wanted to actually be in a rocket, but I knew I wanted to be part of it because of the way John F. Kennedy inspired me. And then when I got there to college, I realized that college physical sciences were a lot more difficult than high school were, and I kind of moved away from that. I didn't have quite the knack that I had when I was in high school, and kind of floated around to different majors. And but all the time circling around that theater building, because there is something about the theater that attracts freaks. Do you know? It's rejects or people who aren't accepted always in other situations, and when you meet them, you feel like you're home. I mean, at least that's what happened to me. Is when I met the group, the people, who, and they are still my best friends.
Okay, so you're saying that you felt that you were somehow not mainstream.
Right, and I think it has to do with, you know, it's no different than it is now when we hear about I mean, I was not bullied at all. I'm not saying that, but when you hear about kids being bullied, it breaks my heart because it's so hard to be different when you're in your teen years, and everyone wants to be loved, right? And so I was. I mean, my God, I was loved, and I had so many good friends, but something. I hadn't found where I belonged in a way, and I think I was hopping around looking for that. And somehow when I found this group, and all you had to be was game, if you were willing to try something in this group. And I think that that's different than, let's say, the physical science department, where you actually needed the kind of brain that can absorb this information and use it, and in other words, you're that bright in that particular way. Or the athletes, they have that particular athletic talent, and I didn't have that. Or you had the desire to teach, or if you've already figured that out. But I think I hadn't figured all that out yet, and I do... recognize my talent and thank my parents, my genes, for giving me that. And I think it wasn't until I, migrated over to that end of campus and met those people and was in that building, I thought, oh, this I can do, and I want to do it. So, And so I went to 4 years there, and while I was there, then all these different auditions come up. And one of them was for what's called University Resident Theater Association, URTA, which still exists today, but it was brand new then. And you would go, I went to Memphis for a general, and then you were accepted, and then I went to Chicago, and I then, and different people said, oh, you come to my university, I'll offer you this,
Wait, slow down. There's something. Did you ever change your major to theater, or you?
Well, you know what? They didn't have that.
So you had a speech major.
The year after I left, and it's now become very. The school is well known for it because I am 4 years ahead of all the Steppenwolf people. Literally right. That's why I know all of them because we shared all these instructors. Right after I left, it became a theater degree, and all of those people came in. And now the school is famous for begetting Steppenwolf. And so now there is a theater major there. But when I was there, it was a speech major. You took a bunch of theater classes, but I graduated with a bachelor's in speech.
Okay, but that's what you did. You did actually change your major.
I did finally change over to speech, I think. It's a very good gen ed school, and so I had taken all the things you needed, and by the time I got to senior year, I then took more specific, some acting and some voice, I think. But then they had the opportunity. They said, okay, who wants to go to these URTA, University Resident Theater Association, auditions? So I went, and of all the offers I got, I picked Florida State University. So I was here 40 years
ago. Wow.
It's the first professional job I had, was on the stage of the Oslo, what is now known as the historic Oslo, but of course it's not even the same boards because it used to be on the water right next to the Katazan.
Yeah.
And then they dismantled that right and built it back up, but it's a different, it's not the wood I walked on those years ago, but that's the theater that I spent.
Wow.
My first professional job was in at the Oslo. And so when I came here for My Fair Lady in 2011, it was 40 years on that I had started my career at this theater. So I came here for an MFA. It was a two-year MFA at that point. And after a year, the cockiness of youth, I got an offer to go to the Cleveland Playhouse, and they said, we'd give you your union card. And I said, I'll take it. I'm leaving. So I didn't finish my MFA. I mean, I loved it here, but I was ready to get on and start my career. And I did. I went there to Cleveland and got my card. So I didn't get, I had, months to go on an MFA. I've never regretted it. I haven't needed it. I've even ended up teaching in a college level without the master's because of experience made up for it. But But those are some of my other dearest friends, the guys that I met in that program, in the MFA program here at... So I knew Howard Millman. He was the artistic director here when I was an apprentice, is what we called them. And Barbara Redman, trying to think of who else. I mean, some of them were passed on. But yeah, so I was here. So to get that opportunity to come back a year, all those years later, to the scene of the crime.
It's really remarkable.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah, it is.
It was a,
okay, so just a sort of thumbnail, what happened between the first time you were here and this time?
Well, I have had a career in this business. I mean, I'm one of those people in the middle of the mushroom. There's the people at the top that we know about and that are famous, and there's the people at the bottom that never work, and there's a whole bunch of us in the middle that have made a living doing this.
Working actors.
Working actors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that includes picking up any TV, film, voiceover, commercial, industrial work that you can get. It includes coaching people. It includes
teaching
at times. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I mean, it also includes babysitting sometimes, you know, during when there's a real long 4-month stretch with no work. But it's for all intents and purposes, I have that. This is, I mean, that's what my tax return has said for many, many years, is that I am a self-employed actor. And like I say, I've lived modestly and been able to make that work.
Okay, I have another question to ask, but before I do, let's talk, just talk about Matchmaker and Good People, so people can... So we can encourage them to come down and see it.
Yeah.
So tell me just whatever comes to mind about those two roles. I'm going to see Good People tomorrow. But,
oh, great.
And I saw Matchmaker on Friday.
The Matchmaker is, Dolly Levi has become somewhat iconic because of Hello, Dolly. I adore this character. I think she is there's a song in... South Pacific, I can't remember the name of the song, but she's a cockeyed optimist. Maybe that's the name of the song, cockeyed optimist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that that's very true of Dolly. No matter what she's handed, she's going to figure out a way to crawl out of that vat, and she will. And I find that optimism and that perseverance so attractive and charming. And I think Thornton Wilder has written an indomitable character. I just adore her. And I am thoroughly enjoying the playing. My sister, I sent some photos to my sisters and brothers to show them these gorgeous costumes. And one sister wrote back, she said, "You must be having fun playing dress up." And I realized I hadn't said those words to myself, and that's exactly what it is. Virgil Johnson's costumes are so stunning and so fun to wear, and they evoke a period that obviously none of us have lived through, but we've seen enough photos and you know, all these movies that we've seen, and I think we all, I don't know about everyone else, I have often, you know, shrunk myself down and imagined myself in situations, right, and put yourself there. And Russell Matheny's sets have, even though there's, you know, you all are out in the audience and there's that fourth wall, there on the stage there is such a complete world created. It really is, for me, feeling like I'm stepping back in time, just having a ball doing it. And Peter Amster's direction and guidance and love in pushing this production all the way to opening night was so invaluable. He understands style and comedy in a way that no other director I've ever worked with does.
Wow.
He knows, and he knows how to make the whole thing work, and the way he makes the whole thing work is to help every person get through, get where they need to be. And so it was a joy. It was huge production.
Yes.
It's huge. It's as big as a musical. And I'm still impressed that we got it up in the time that we did. But I think, from what the audience has been telling me, is that, it's so fun to watch, and I just love seeing the costumes, and it's just, we just had such a good time. So there's just a good feeling, a warm feeling, a cozy feeling, a familiar feeling about it that's just magical in some ways. And we just had our first preview last night of Good People, and it's, as far as a theatrical experience, it's pretty night and day. This is contemporary. It's much different in terms of, there's six of us in Good People, there's 18 of us, so it's just a wonderful circus and matchmaker. And this is a much smaller piece in Good People, but wow, is it a ride for the theater, or for the audience. There is a lot of laughs in it, but it hits on points of class, gender, and race. You will be laughing about it, but I know you'll go out ready to discuss it with whoever you came with, or just think about it yourself. It's a very it's a really well-written play. David Lindsay Abaire wrote Good People, and wow, is it a good one. Our leading lady, Denise Cormier, is stunning. She's just amazing. In this one, I'm not the lead. In Matchmaker, I am. In this one, I'm a really good feature role. But Denise is helming this one, and wow, she's terrific. So very different audience experiences. I know it will be for them, and what a great treat to have it, too.
Well, yeah. And another opportunity to watch the very versatile Peggy Broder.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome. So my only other question is, and really in a way you've been talking about it, having spent a life, and you have spent a life doing this work, is there anything that you would say about what that is like?
You know, it wasn't until about 10 years ago I finally realized that I don't know when I put it together, but you know how a doctor always has a pager on him, and he's pretty much 24/7. And I realized, that's what I've been doing all these years. I have always said to my family, yes, I'll be there unless I get an audition, a job, whatever.
Unless I have a patient.
And that was the thing, is that right. The doctor will be there on Christmas Day, and then he gets beeped because he has to go deliver a baby.
Right.
And I thought, doctors may be paid more than we do, than we are as actors, but it's the same thing. I'm always on call.
Yes.
And I have been. And that can be exhausting. I am not going to pretend that, that I'm overworked, because I know people in the world have much more difficult jobs, and they don't get applauded at the end of doing their job. I do. So I get a lot of great feedback. But I realize that that's why it's so important for an artist to find ways to bring their adrenaline count down. It's just you have got to figure out a way to de-stress and to stay relaxed, because you're always on. You always have to be ready, because that's how quickly things happen in this business, But I think now that I'm coming to, I'm certainly not retiring anytime soon, but I'm in a different position than when you're starting your career and
you have to work to get it.
Yes.
Right.
Now I've been able to save a little money, I'm taking care of myself, and so I feel a little sense of relaxation that I realize, wow, that really was a lot of
energy
and expended, just always looking for, because you're always looking for work.
You're either working or looking for it.
Well, you're doing the same. There's not a real long honeymoon. We all laugh because it's like rehearsal's great, but as soon as the show opens, you have to enjoy the run of the show, but you're also going, okay, what's next? Yeah. What's next? It's one of the other reasons this is such a dream job is because we come down here for 5.5 months, and most of our jobs are 8 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks, you know, by the time you rehearse.
And when you're not working because you know what's coming next. You don't have to...
Right, exactly, down here. And so in another 2 months, I'll start worrying about what comes after this. But I'm still just enjoying the fact that I'm employed here till the middle of April. And what a treat, what a gift, you know, to have that much work. So,
well, yeah. This from Peggy Roeder, who is a gift.
Yeah, oh, thank
truly,
you.
Truly, that's a great place to stop. Thank you very much. Come out and see her in everything she does.
Oh, thank you, Liz. Yes, welcome. Please come to the Oslo.
So there you have it, what it sounds like when you are really who you are. Peggy says that she has arranged her life so that she can do what she must do, so that she can be herself. She says she's lived modestly. It was not about how extravagantly she could live for Peggy. For Peggy, it was clear from the moment she discovered who she was that this work was what was so important to her. And of course, this is why she's so extraordinary at what she does. So we're going to go out on me reading Sharon Leslie's review of Good People as I read her review of Matchmaker. And so I'm going to say, as I always do, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that amused you, tickled you, informed you, inspired you. Something that'll bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too. What constitutes a good person? These are the questions that gnaw at the core of the bright red apple that is the production of Good People at the Oslo Repertory Theater. As the Oslo continues to delve into their 5-year quest to define exactly what it is that makes Americans uniquely American, Good People explores the attitudes and lives found in the blue-collar neighborhood of Boston known as Southie. At the heart of the play are two characters from Southie, Margie, who, for a variety of reasons, is still in Southie, scraping together a living at meager, low-paying jobs, and Mike, who clawed his way out through education and became a doctor living in the upper crust Chestnut Hill area. While life circumstances have set them only a couple of blocks apart, Margie and Mike's economic reality and usage of the English language has set them a universe apart. Mike got out, Margie didn't. But as they say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. As this play proceeds, we discover that both of these characters have a problem with the truth, and both of these characters have an edge of desperation because of things that happened to them growing up in Southie. Moreover, Mike makes a surprising move, not fully explored in the play, and marries an educated black woman. In this study of class in America, perhaps a female white Boston Brahmin would not have been allowed to marry a Southie. The Apple Crisp Dialogue by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright David Lindsay Ebert is spoken with a thick but easily understandable Southie accent, and it's fun to listen to for that reason. As Margie, Denise Cormier, brings a survivalist energy to this juicy part that won a Tony for Frances McDormand. There is pathos in her desperation that allows us to almost forgive her most desperate of moves. Actor Tim Grimm, as Mike, shows the focused determination of an escapee who planted the seeds and tended the tree until it bore fruit. The playwright also imbues this character with aspects of a different kind of survivalist, one who wants to forget the past and leave it hidden. Other actors make each bite of this apple pie of a cast tasty. The inimitable Peggy Roeder brings out the hard and soft edges of Margie's landlord. Dottie Anna Marie Cousanas adds ginger, and Jory Murphy, as a soft-hearted former boss, adds the vanilla cream.
I particularly enjoyed the extra layer of toppings that Tyla Abercrombie brought to the table as Mike's literature teachering wife, Kate. The set design allows us to visually experience the smelly garbage bin existence that pervades the lives of those in Southie, while contrasting it with the sleek beauty of the wealthier home in Chestnut Hill. The direction of Greg Lemming keeps the pace flowing as the play needles us with the humor that tries to diffuse the pain. After seeing this show, what begs to be explored with friends over coffee or with wine and a huge tray of cheese, as is used in the play, is the question of what allows one person to escape the clutches of a neighborhood like Southie and not the other. The playwright puts forth what each of these characters thinks. Mike thinks it's hard work, but Margie says, "I work hard." Margie thinks it's luck. Mike retorts, "Luck didn't get me into college." Both of these characters are, quote, good people, unquote. Both look after other people. Both have a past, but one is more bruised by that past than the other. Neither is a rotten apple that spoils the whole bunch. What's great about this play is that the question is not resolved. No one's life is perfect. You can have your pie and eat it too, but when tomorrow comes, you still have to go out and pick another apple. Good People is a delicious production that leaves us with something to chew on. Bon appetit.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't.